listening to KBOO Portland.
In 1949, in Berkeley, a new kind of radio station was born.
Brotherhood.
In the community.
Freedom and justice.
On the air, Berkeley Boo, a popular marijuana strain gave Boo the call name, was and is the truth.
Truth as we see it.
A basement in Old Town was donated for less than $4,000. An important force on Portland's airwaves was born.
Action against injustice
is what we stand for, and we fuel the fire together. And KBOO's listeners is why community radio in Portland thrives.
Powerful and just
is how I describe KBOO. And together, we make the grass greener. Thank you, Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Calhoun. Thank you, Gray. Thank you, KBOO. Please go to kboo.fm/giveaway to support KBOO right now.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Welcome to episode 5 of Stories with Stella, and I want to talk about a couple media portrayals of sex, organs, sex work, and the like, by starting off with a wonderful performance piece that's been going on for many years that was originally done by a woman named Eve Ensler, and the piece is called The Vagina Monologues. And my mom actually first showed this to me when I was a young teen, maybe 12 or 13, and I recently rewatched it. It's now on HBO, and it's very eye-opening and touching and heartwarming and educational. So I highly recommend that to anyone who's got some time to kill during quarantine, like a lot of us do. And the whole premise of the show is Eve Ensler spends years going around and kind of interviewing women all over the world about their vaginas, about their relationship to their vagina, what they call it, do they look at it, have they touched it for more than just going to the bathroom purposes, have they ever touched themselves sexually, and it's really beautiful. And she shares some of the footage from some of the interviews she captured, and then she writes monologues about or inspired by some of the interviews that she's had. And some of them are just, they hit you right in the heart. One of them was about a woman who I think was in her 70s and had never had an orgasm in her life. And she'd had children, but she'd never experienced the pleasure of her own clit. And she finally met a therapist when she was in her 70s in New York who recommended she go home and set the mood and touch herself. And so she did that, and it took a while, but she was finally able to make herself have an orgasm. And she shared that it made her cry because she was just so overwhelmed with the feeling and what her body could do. And it's really beautiful to hear the stories, all the different stories that people have with their vaginas. Some cultures, it's more common for mothers to talk to their daughters about their period or having sex or masturbation, but a lot of cultures don't talk about those things. And those are kind of unspoken experiences. And so a lot of people go through many years or their entire lives without being comfortable exploring their own bodies. And I've had conversations with friends who grew up very Catholic and who always felt like God was watching them, and if they masturbated, they were going to go to hell. So a lot of really intense societal and cultural pressures have made it so that a lot of people don't talk about their vaginas. In fact, we don't even use those words a lot. Penis, vagina. And Eve Ensler talks about that too. Those are not very pretty words. They're kind of blunt words. They don't flow off the tongue that easily. And she talks about all of the many, 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 many different names that people have come up with for their vaginas over the years. They also really talk about hair preferences and how those can vary. And some people enjoy having no hair. Some people enjoy having a little hair. Some people enjoy having a big full bush. And all of those are okay. And there's somebody out there who enjoys all of those preferences as well. When I first started dancing, I completely shaved myself thinking that, well, that's what a lot of people see in porn. That must be what a lot of the customers are going to want to see as well. And very quickly, within a few weeks of working, I got a lot of feedback from customers that no hair made them uncomfortable because it reminded them of a young child and that was not their forte. And they liked seeing hair on a woman. And so I started growing out my bush again. And I personally don't like a full bush. It gets caught in my underwear, it gets caught while I'm having sex. So I like to keep a trimmed bush. But there's a whole variety of preferences out there, and they are all absolutely okay, and they're all valid, whatever makes you feel the most comfortable with your body. I have friends who suffer from really intense razor bumps, and so it's more comfortable for them to have a full bush, because if they try to shave anything at all, they get little bumps, and it's very uncomfortable. Something else I really like about Eve Ensler's portrayal of the vagina monologues is she asks everyone a question, the same question. If your vagina could say anything, what would it say? And a lot of the responses that she got were, my vagina would say, slow down, lubricate me, take care of me, touch me, explore me. And I thought that was a really interesting question because I myself have dealt with going too fast, especially when it comes with my vagina. I have peed too hard in the past and given myself a bladder cramp from trying to push that pee out. And I've tried to have sex without enough of a warm-up. And the vagina is a muscle. It will respond. It'll stretch when it's ready, and it'll contract when it's not. And that's something that, again, I really encourage everyone to explore their own bodies and touching themselves, because we can't expect anyone else to know how to touch us and make us feel good if we don't know how to make ourselves feel good. If we don't already have a relationship with our pleasure center, then there's no way we can expect anybody else to be able to find that. And that can be very frustrating. So, big fan of exploring your body and not talking badly about bodies, because they come in all different shapes and sizes, and I think that that's a really beautiful thing. I grew up in a bit of a hippie family, and it was common for us to go to nude hot springs my entire childhood. And I really appreciated that looking back, and even at the time, because I got to see a lot of different bodies and all different ages, nude, relaxed, lounging around, in the pool, stretching. But I got to see the variety of what bodies can look like. And getting to see that from a really young age, I think, helped a lot as I got older. And when I became a teenager, I think a lot of people, when their bodies start to change, go through feeling uncomfortable and comparing themselves a lot to other people too. And so I really value the time that I got to spend very normalized at nude hot springs with my family, because I got to see so many different types of bodies in so many different forms, and it helped me feel more comfortable and more secure in my body as it was changing when I was going through puberty. And as an adult, I still very much enjoy nude hot springs for the freedom of being able to be nude out in nature and see other people who are comfortable and confident in their bodies and not feeling the need to hide their uniqueness, because our uniqueness is what makes us each special. We're all like fingerprints. None of us are alike. And I think that's a thing to value. And a lot of our culture holds these stereotypes that people hold themselves to of what they should look like. But in reality, all humans look completely different. There is no norm. Whatever is healthiest for you is healthiest for you and you only. So that's a little bit of my own experience around nudity and how I think that really helped me. And something I want to work on more, because I've been catching myself lately making jokes about bodies and specifically about penis size. And that's something that I've come to realize is just as bad as making jokes about vaginas or breast size or butt size. It's in poor taste. It's antiquated. It doesn't need to be a thing anymore. And so I'm catching myself and I'm phasing that out of my vocabulary, because for a long time that's been a pretty common joke to make. But I'm recognizing more and more how offensive it is and how much it contributes to people's self-esteem and people comparing themselves or feeling like there is a standard for any kind of body size, whether it be penis size, pussy lip size, butt size, breast size, all of the above, anything else, elbows, whatever you want to focus on. There is no norm. There is no standard. Everyone's different. And a joke that I hear a lot about vaginas is calling them meat flaps. Somebody has got extra labia or a lot of external labia, and people make fun of that. And I know several women who felt very ashamed of the way that their vagina looks because of these kinds of jokes. When I know from being a woman, a human, a stripper, every man I know would just cherish and adore being able to look at their vaginas, but they still feel embarrassed somehow because, well, not somehow, because of these cultural stereotypes and these jokes. And small dick jokes fall into the same category. And so I'm saying no more to that for myself, and I'm gonna catch other people when they do that too. Because it's the same thing about breast size. When I was younger, I wanted my breasts to be bigger because I thought that that was what was womanly or what was acceptably femme. And it took me years to get to the point where I love my smaller titties. But that shouldn't be the way it is. And breast size has become already outdated. People don't make those jokes as much. Butt size, it's fading out. But dick size, that's alive and well, and I hear those jokes a lot. And I'm partaking them, and so I want to stop partaking in those jokes, and I encourage everyone else to phase those out. Because even if they're funny in the moment, if anyone is overhearing that and already has some sort of insecurity about the size of one of their body parts, that's just going to make them feel worse. And we don't want that. Nobody wants that. We don't want to make people feel worse. We want to make people feel better. We want to make people feel happy. At least that's my goal, and I hope it's all of your goals too. I'm gonna take a break there and play some music for y'all, and then I'll be back to continue my rambling.
Dip me in chocolate sauce and then lick off all my toes. Paint me in marmalade, your mama ain't got to know. Stay here in bed with me till way past afternoon. And drape me in jasmine vines in this Crescent City swoon. I got got the flavor, baby. You just give me the time. Ain't no misbehaving, I got your best interest in mind. I got the flavor, baby. You just give me the time. Ain't no misbehaving, I got your best interest in mind. Drink me down in one long drop and then taste me the whole way down. I don't know what it is about me, I just know that I love this sound. Cherry pie, my sugar sweet, that's how they know my name. Once you come around my kitchen, baby, ain't nothing gonna be the same. I got the flavor, baby, you just give me the time. Ain't no misbehaving, I got your best interest in mind. I got the flavor, baby, you just give me the time. Ain't no misbehaving, I got your best interest in mind.
Thank you. one time. It's passing me by.
Welcome back again. For this next bit, I want to talk about a movie that came out probably about 10 years or so ago called The Sessions. And it's a movie that did pretty well because Helen Hunt played a sex therapist in it for a man who was paralyzed from polio and wanted to explore intimacy and sexuality and was unable to move but did not lack the desire for human connection and vulnerability. It was a beautiful movie. I believe it was based on a real story. I remember seeing it even 10-ish years ago and thinking, huh, isn't this just sex work? But somehow it was palatable to the general public, and it was a movie that aired in movie theaters all over. I remember kind of being confused because even from a young age, I understood that there was a taboo around talking about sex work or sex therapy or even just therapy. So I remember it kind of struck me, and there's not a lot of portrayal of sex workers or sex therapists in media, and a lot of times when they are, they're usually used as props for jokes about murder or drug abuse or domestic abuse. And it was really fascinating to me how receptive people were to the movie The Sessions, because it represented the sex work in a very clinical setting. And as if because this person has a medical reason and their insurance might even cover this, then it's appropriate. But if somebody is paying cash to somebody they met off the internet to meet them at an agreed upon place for some human contact, then therefore it's not as palatable to the public. And that was kind of the one thing that stood out to me, especially about The Sessions, was that, yes, it's a movie about sex work, but it's portrayed in this above board, appropriate for upper middle class white people kind of way. And sex work has survived as an industry for so long because it's provided a source of opportunity and income for minorities, for people who are in financial stress, who are in any number of situations due to a lack of privilege. And so that's something that I think needs to be highlighted a lot more in media portrayals of sex workers, is that it's not just $2,000 a night white girls on Wall Street. A lot of the people who rely on the industry are not able to charge somebody's credit card for their services. There is one film out there that I really, really love. It's called Tangerine, and I believe it was all shot on an iPhone, and it follows a black trans sex worker around the Bay Area from their point of view. And I think it's very beautifully done and a rarity out there, because there's not a lot of real, authentic experiences from actual sex workers' point of views. A lot of times they are used as a prop to make fun of in a lot of media, and Tangerine, I think, was done really beautifully in a way that it just showed the life and or one life and one experience and the ups and the downs that is life in general, no matter what industry you're in. So that movie is called Tangerine, and it's one of my favorites. I recommend it to a lot of people. And it's just shot really amazingly as well. And I think another thing kind of connected to this a little bit, just the sex worker conversation at all, is I think a lot of people think that arousal has to be a factor for somebody to engage in sex work or sex therapy. But a lot of times when people are seeking out these services, it's because there's something else that's coming up. It might not be that their penis can't get hard or their vagina won't get wet. It might be that there's an intimacy block or a safety block or an issue with vulnerability or something that people need the experience of a professional to hold space and teach them how to explore a new experience. And yes, sometimes that does involve genitals, but it doesn't have to be. A lot of sex work experiences, it's a lot more about the exchange of energy than it is necessarily about the exchange of bodily fluids. So on that note, I'm gonna take another little break, play some music, and then come back and check in with my roommate, Hazel, about her work in the death industry. And that's another topic that is almost as taboo, if not more, than sex. And so we're going to dive into all the complications of death work when we come back.
Was it all of love? Are you in a gold? Didn't cage, are you in a daze? Did you even hear them say? Ain't it strange after everything changed? If you come back that place, I was feel the same. 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 I was still. Go away. You never know now, you never know what I'm saying. You never know what I'm dreaming. You never know now, you never know what's showing. Now I don't know where I'm going. You never know now, you never know. Love. Were you in a golden cage? Were you in a daze? Did you even hear them say? Was it like a dream?
but you in a goal. Doing place while something strong. But a smile on your face. Ain't it strange after everything changed? If you come back that place, I would still feel the same. 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 I would still.
Sitting here with my roommate Hazel, who just started a job in the death industry. Tell me about it.
That's me. Hi, I'm back. So far so good. I have no complaints.
What is the job that you do?
Okay, just to clarify, I work at a mortuary, not to be confused with a funeral home. We're actually contracted by somewhat or other around 50 funeral homes in the greater Portland area. And we're basically like the death hub. So we bring in decedents, we bring them out, we store them, we do cremation and aquamation services, and basically act as a holding facility, but we also provide extra services such as like police escorts for a funeral procession, or we just have a lot of extra equipment. So if a smaller privately owned funeral home needs extra hands or extra equipment, we can also rent that out.
Wow. And so what has been your take on it versus the expectations you had going into the industry? Has it changed much?
Yeah, so going in, I was pretty set on the idea that I wanted to go to mortuary school and become a licensed mortician. But after, I was actually privileged to be in a position to where I get to see all sides of it. If I had just gone in straight away working at a funeral home, I would not have gotten to see all the different sides and windows to it, because we work with hospitals, we work with institutions, we're on medical examiner calls. So
you even go to people's private homes to pick up bodies, right?
Right, we go to residences. Pretty much any time somebody passes, we're there no matter where it is.
And that is such an interesting position to be in, because I think a lot of people think about not wanting to think about death, but don't actually think about what happens afterwards, or what happens if one of your own loved ones dies, like what the steps are to do that, and who to call, and basically who's going to come do your job and bag them and tag them. And it seems like a very, very taboo subject. What are the people like that you've been interacting with? Families, associates?
Yeah, so I feel like going into it, there was just this stereotype of old creepy white dudes being in the funeral service. And
in every industry.
Yeah, well, I was pleasantly surprised to find out that the majority of the people that work at my place of work are women, and younger women in their 20s and 30s. So I often get the same kind of reaction when I go to house calls, and it's like a little old lady and her husband passed, and she's like, "Oh, you're the transport? Like, I expected some big old dude."
And so you have to learn how to use like equipment to pick up bodies and put them in bags and everything like that. You're telling me some stories about having to break rigor, and that sounds pretty intense. Something a lot of people, I think, don't think about as well.
Yeah, sometimes people don't die in the most convenient positions.
Gosh darn them.
And when we go to remove them, we have to do some finagling to get them where they need to be safely. We use medical-style gurneys, just like you would see in EMT or in a hospital. And when we're going to institutions, they have a similar setup where it's like a hospice bed, and it's a lot more medical than people would think. I feel like in somewhat or another, we're just death nurses. We're doing kind of a lot of the same stuff, working with the same equipment, going in and out of institutions. And it's really interesting what I've learned just from seeing the backside of hospitals and going into the morgues and funeral homes.
Especially late at night, too, which sounds a little creepy, having to show up at a morgue at 3 a.m. and pick up a body.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely, every season is spooky season for me.
You're a spooky bitch. How's it been telling people about that job? Like, having gone from being a stripper and navigating that conversation with people, has it been tricky telling people about it? Do you get a lot of the same questions or reactions?
You know what? I was really nervous to actually break the news to people close to me and even my family, because a lot of people are just so far removed from even wanting to do their own research and learning about it. They know nothing. So it's kind of become part of my job to explain myself, which A lot of people, I feel like, don't have to do with their jobs. They're like, okay, mm-hmm. I do this. And then it's going to be well received for the most part. But
more represented in media or more talked about in general.
Right. For me, I have to go in with this whole explanation. And I even feel almost obligated to tell people where I want to take it, because the reaction I get often is something along the lines of, well, nobody wants to do that. Why are you doing that? And I was like, some people do want to do it.
I actually do want to do that. I actually enjoy making coffee and serving tables. There's a lot of jobs that I think a lot of people think nobody would ever want to do that, but somebody's got to do it. And there are people like you out there who are actually interested in it and not afraid to tackle such an unknown subject. Did you do a lot of research before applying for jobs about the death industry, or have you been just learning a ton being in it?
So all my research prior to entering the industry was more focused on the mortician side of things and how to become a funeral director. And I was actually considering applying to mortuary school for a while. But when this opportunity came about, I thought I might as well dip my toes in and see what it's all about before I commit to another degree that I'm not going to use.
Totally. So, and this is just giving you so many opportunities to see so many different fields. There's something you mentioned earlier that I want you to explain because it's really cool. The aqua thing.
Right. So the company that I work for has organs only high-powered alkaline hydrolysis machine for humans. And alkaline hydrolysis, also known as aquamation, is a pretty up-and-coming technology. In the last few years, it was mainly tested on animals, like pets. But recently, it's become more environmentally friendly alternative to cremation. It essentially does the same thing. You put the body in the machine. It uses alkaline and water and a lot of pressure to essentially dissolve it.
Wild.
It spits out the bones, and then we crush them up to a ash-like substance that you would see in a normal cremation. And it looks just about the same, but it's not emitting those greenhouse gases like you would in a traditional fire cremation.
Interesting. Yeah, it seems like a lot of the ways that people have to be disposed of if you're going to be cremated or buried, there's an effect on the environment, but not so much with aquamation.
It's definitely less intense than cremation, and also doesn't propose the issue of burial where, like, the earth could eventually erode or a pipeline could break, and mm-hmm. that has its own set of problems depending on where you live and if you're near any big bodies of water.
Yeah, you don't want your corpse just floating around somewhere years later.
I mean, that was a huge issue back in, what was it, 2000?
In Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, in Hurricane Katrina, where the owner of my company actually is part of an organization, which I think is the coolest thing. It's a national organization for morticians that's focused specifically on disaster relief. So some of the nation's most prominent morticians will get together in a big natural disaster, Hurricane Katrina, for example, 9/11, and they'll go and help supplement and deal with the dead bodies.
So like while what Red Cross is busy dealing with hurt people, they'll go in and help dispose of all the bodies.
Right, because there are times when it's just so overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember hearing about Haiti and how there were bodies that they couldn't even find for a long time. And then when they did, they just didn't even know where to put them all.
Right. So many go unidentified in disasters like that. So it's amazing that we even have organizations like that. That was something that I was introduced to.
Yeah, that's amazing. What's the, there's a book that you were reading about by that woman who's like a really famous mortician. Who's that?
Caitlin Doughty, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been really interested in hearing a lot of what you've had to say about her and all the different death practices on different places of the world, too.
Oh, yeah, she's great. She was actually a big source of my inspiration for wanting to enter the death industry. The way she describes it in her books is just so humanizing, if that's even a word.
Absolutely. I feel like death is, people see it as a not human thing, even though it's one of the most human things besides birth.
Exactly. People spend their whole lives trying to avoid it, but why avoid the inevitable and deal with some avoidable feelings?
Totally. Sex is a choice. Not everyone's gonna have sex, but everyone's gonna die. We're all gonna know people who are gonna die too, so being able to have those conversations is so important. I feel like a lot of people just don't even want to think about that. I myself don't even want to think about my dog dying someday, but it is something that's gonna happen, and being comfortable going about that when the time comes, I think, is really important.
And just the better prepared you are emotionally, not just emotionally, but having all of your will in order and making sure you get your last rites. And a lot of people, I guess, don't expect to die in a sudden way, so they don't have those things in order, and it kind of puts a lot of pressure on the family, and it forces them to make decisions that the decedent might not want. For example, a kind of hot topic in the industry right now, just a POC thing, is the trans community and people that were rejected by their families and not having the way that they would want to be disposed in their will. And so their families will present them a certain way, ask the funeral homes to present them in a way that they didn't live by or didn't want to be identified as. And that can be problematic, and that's part of not honoring the person that you love even after they're gone.
Absolutely, and making it more about you and not that person. Huh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I remember being excited when I turned 18 and I finally made myself an organ donor on my license. But I want to take more steps to draw up a will and just get that paperwork in order. The more we've been talking about it, I've been thinking about, because yeah, we never know when or what is going to happen. So having that can help so much, like you're saying, with the community while they're going through their time of grief, to also be able to have that already.
I love that you're an organ donor. I am too. A story of the night. I actually just got home from work and I got to sit in on an embalmer who removed the corneas from a person just to donate their eyes, and that was a crazy procedure. I saw some things.
Oh, so yeah, it's like you can't just take a spoon and scoop them out. You gotta do a careful thing to make them viable for the next person.
Right. And I was also under the impression that any kind of organ donation scenario had to be done immediately, but the eyes are different. This guy was dead for a day or two.
Interesting.
So,
like, as long as they're hydrated before they dry out or something.
I honestly don't know the medical side of it, but
that's really cool to know.
It was a quick procedure. Like, he had it done in about half hour.
I'm an organ donor on my license. That means full body, right? So they could do like the brain donation, because brain donation, you don't have to do a special thing to donate your brain. They'll just take any of your organs when you die, right?
Well, there is a prerequisite list, so you have to be pre-approved if you want to donate your brain. But as long as you don't have any pre-existing conditions, like, obviously they're not going to take a liver from somebody on dialysis.
Totally, that makes sense.
But as long as you're a relatively healthy person and you didn't die in a super traumatic way that would damage any organs, then yeah, pretty much good to go.
Interesting. That was something... trigger warning, suicide. That was something that I learned from my friend who's a nurse, that a lot of times with suicides, if people choose different routes, they can't use certain organs. So like if people overdose on a lot of pills, a lot of times it makes their organs not okay to donate. And so that was something that he'd never really thought about until he worked in the ER and the ICU. And when they had suicide patients come in who were on their way out, they would usually ask how they did it, just so that they would know if they could donate. So that was something I also thought was interesting in a dark way.
Totally.
Is there anything else you want to share about the death industry and just the uniqueness of that?
Well, something that I found really interesting and also made me kind of mad. I'm an internet troll. I'm just going to start out this little sentence like that. So I love to, I'm part of so many different really niche Facebook groups, and I love just popping in, and usually I'm just a voyeur in those scenarios, but I decided to make a post for the first time in one of the groups called Hidden Portland. And so the idea is to basically post a picture of something that you find around the city that is unique or interesting, just one of those things that, quote, air quote, keeps Portland weird, because people just love to go and, like, you know, find weird facts about the city, and then it allows other people to go and on somewhat of a treasure hunt if they want to go find it. So you can, cool, like, leave clues to where it is and whatnot. So I posted something about my place of work, because it's actually located right alongside the I-84, which is one of the main freeways going west, east to west, through the city. And I just posted something like, fun fact, this is Portland's largest mortuary, and it actually houses, you know, the only high-powered human alkaline hydrolysis machine. And I kind of went in on a short explanation of how alkaline hydrolysis is a much more environmentally friendly alternative to cremation. And it's still kind of new on the market, so a lot of people just don't even know it's an option. So that was just kind of my idea of getting it out there. And the first thing I noticed about the post is it took nearly a week to get approved. A lot of the times when you post on groups, you know, there's admins on it that will post it within an hour, like, maximum. So it took around 5 days for it to get approved. And I was actually debating messaging the admins, asking if I had, like, broken any of the rules. Usually I, like, read all the rules to make sure that what I'm posting is applicable to the group and nobody's gonna get mad at me.
Totally.
So it finally got posted, and one of the admins commented, it was like, well, let's keep this respectful, like, blah blah blah. And everybody was just asking very curious, appropriate questions.
Yeah,
and
that's a really interesting thing.
She actually ended up censoring a lot of what people had to say about death, and I just found it so strange. Death is just as important as, like, life. I mean, yeah, birth, like, it's the same on that circle.
It's inevitable. It's going to happen to all of us. So why censor that information?
I just thought that was so strange, because I know we did an episode about the censorship of sex workers online.
Mm-hmm.
And I do understand that's a little more taboo, but death is, that's the thing, mm-hmm, and nobody can avoid that. Everybody, yeah, can be like, sex work is not for me, that shouldn't be on the internet. But death, that's for everyone. That's for everyone. Everybody's involved.
Even for kids, if it's like an age-appropriate thing, I get why, like, stripping or sex work or porn can have age restrictions so that children don't have access. But children still need to know about death. There's still conversations about it, and I feel like that shouldn't be something that seemed inappropriate or in need of being censored. That just seems so ridiculous, because it's just so essential.
Right. And that was just something that, like, really surprised me, because I knew it was more of a unpopular opinion type subject, but I didn't think it would actually get censored. And I didn't think that my voice would be silenced just talking about what I do for a living.
And this really amazing, environmentally friendly equipment.
Yeah, for the most part, all the commenters were like, oh, I didn't know this was a service, like, I'm going to definitely look into it. Or, like, people were commenting, I have this terminal illness and I'm actually working on my death plan right now, like, this is really great information. Or some people were just plain old fascinated. They were like, I had no idea. Wow. Like,
it's another one of those things that without it being out there in the conversation, people don't know, and therefore we're curious about it.
Yeah, I was just, like, overwhelmed at the amount of positive comments I got, and then how ill-received it was by the admins, and they were so reluctant. I feel like they probably would have deleted it if it hadn't kind of blown up. Like, the post ended up getting over 700 shares.
Wow.
And I don't know. So I've never been like internet famous or anything, but I was just like, wow, it's something that I shared with the community and
educated a lot of people about.
And they were trying to shut me up. And I was like, that's just not cool. Like, I was actually heated. So crazy world we live in.
So wild. Well, I'm excited for your adventures to continue in this industry and to learn more through you.
Yeah, it's definitely been an adventure so far, and I hope I can turn it into a full career. Right now I'm taking it pretty slow, but
dipping your toes in.
Mm-hmm. But I'm learning so much, and every day is different, which I love. I'm a really dynamic worker. I don't think I would have much success being confined to an office job. So being able to interact with, you know, the firemen, the police, the medical examiners, the hospital workers, it's never a boring, dull moment.
There is something special about that. There's a lot of jobs that get very boring, but that's one where I don't think you'll find that.
Definitely not. And it really shifted my perspective in a way that historically I've been just doing jobs to make money, but this seems like something that I'm passionate about. And it really like shifts your perspective in the long term, because now I'm thinking of it as like, you know, setting goals and like, how can I advance? Like, mm-hmm. What's next?
Move forward and learn more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like a great industry for you.
So far, so good.
Well, thanks for sharing a little bit about that. I'm excited to chat more in the future as there's more to talk about.
Oh, yeah. I got some crazy stories, so anytime you'd like to hear them.
Well, Happy New Year's, everyone. Thanks for joining us for the 5th episode and our first one of the year. And we'll talk to you next month.
Feel it in my head, feel it in my bones. Everything. Portland.
Hi, this is Clarity. I live in Eastern Oregon, and I've been a long-time listener. KBOO has helped me through